This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The Suffolk County District Attorney's Office concluded this week that Boston police and the FBI were justified in last summer's fatal shooting of a man who was under surveillance for alleged ties to a terrorist group. DA Dan Conley announced Wednesday that police acted in self-defense in the shooting of 26-year-old Osama Rahim.
Mr. Rahim continued to advance on the officers, refused to drop his weapon, and responded by saying, "You drop yours, and why don't you shoot me?" Mr. Rahim continued his armed advance until he was within several feet of the officers.
But the attorney for Rahim's family, Ronald Sullivan, called for a follow-up investigation, and he asked why, if Rahim was so dangerous, wasn't he arrested?
If they had enough information to justify an arrest, they could have gotten a warrant and effected an arrest the proper way.
Some civil liberties groups are also calling for an independent investigation. So where does this case go from here? With us in the studio to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is our Week in Review panel. John Carroll is with us. He's WBUR's senior media analyst and a professor of communication at Boston University. Hello.
Hi, Deb.
Also with us, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Great to see you.
Same here.
Okay, so initial reactions from both of you to the results of DA Connolly's investigation and his decision not to pursue charges against the officers in the shooting death of Rahim. John.
Well, I think there are enough eyewitness accounts that seem to back up what the DA found. But I think the problem is one of perception, for one thing. When the DA is investigating law enforcement officials, every DA has to work with closely, that presents a potential conflict of interest. You also have the idea that, they knew he was dangerous. They were wiretapping him. They had heard a phone call earlier in the day that indicated he was going to go after a police officer, and that also he didn't expect to survive the day. One of the questions is, why didn't they have a plan B? I'm not a law enforcement official, but it seems to me a taser might have been a good sort of alternative choice in terms of apprehending him.
Right. Arlene, do you agree? I mean, this is what many folks are saying. Why not de-escalate this situation? And is this an isolated incident here of police use of force, or is it symptomatic of a bigger problem?
Well, I think the questions that are being asked are right on point. And I think that is the reason, with a capital T, to have an independent investigation, an investigation done not by the DA, who, as John said, is associated with the police very closely and works with them, but have a truly independent entity do it. And in fact, that should be standard operating procedure, no matter how justified the shooting appears to be. I mean, it sounds like the police may very well have handled this appropriately, but I don't usually quote Ronald Reagan, but I think it's important to trust but verify. And the best way to do that is to have it done by someone that is not involved directly or indirectly in the investigation.
Another thing that could help in this situation that the lawyer for the ACLU of Massachusetts had called for was audio tape of the wiretap phone call.
Right.
He says, "I'd feel a lot better about this if I knew what was on that phone call
and why police felt so threatened, because
exactly,
that's where the alleged threats were made." Well, I also want to play another piece of tape from District Attorney Conley, because in this cut here, he talks about video footage and how that was used in this investigation. Let's listen.
"We relied heavily on the 18 witnesses who told us, and the videos are helpful because they tend to corroborate witness statements. And the civilians corroborated the police officers and the FBI agents. So in total, cumulatively, it pointed to a justified shooting."
So the reason that I think that this is significant, video footage, that's partially the idea, right, behind police cameras, another issue in the news this week. In Boston, training began for a pilot program for 100 officers to start wearing body cameras. Now, the officers won't start wearing them until next week. This is just the training this week. And on WBUR's Morning Edition this week, we spoke with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh about this, and he says that the cameras have to be phased in slowly. Let's listen to what he had to say.
"It's a change in the way that police do their work. It's another piece of technology that they have to be careful of, something else they have to make sure that when they report, that they work accurately on their reports. So I think at the end of the day, we'll be able to see through this pilot the comfort of the police officers.
So is it about time for Boston Police to be doing this? And is the mayor right here that this needs to be sort of phased in slowly so all the questions about what you do with video footage and all of that are answered properly?
Well, I think it's a good idea to phase it in. I think there are problems with body cams, but in a lot of cases, everyone involved in these incidents or these encounters feels better about having the body cam because they understand that there's a record of what's going on. So if a motorist is stopped, a motorist can sometimes feel more comfortable or more secure because the body camera is there. I think that it's unfortunate that the way they rolled out this pilot program was asking for voluntary police officers to step forward. I think that that might have been a mistake because now the union is saying this, you know, you randomly assign these cameras. That's not the deal we had. And
but no one volunteered.
No one volunteered, but there was no, in the initial agreement that they made with the union, there was no provision for if people didn't volunteer. It was just, this is going to be a voluntary program. So I think that that other police forces have had the body cams basically given to them, assigned to them, and there was no voluntary aspect to it at all. So I think maybe that was one of the things in hindsight that they might go back and wish they hadn't done.
Eileen, what are you thinking about this whole controversy in Boston about the use of body cams? We also read in the Boston Globe this week, this has been happening in Methuen, other communities, obviously other states have them. Why do we seem to be having a hard time?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Body-worn cameras for the police really, in my mind, are inevitable. It both protects the police, it validates what their version of the story may have been the incident most of the time, but it also will protect the public when a cop maybe isn't honest or maybe isn't acting appropriately. But you've got to do it right. You know, I know the ACLU has a campaign called Do It Right, that you make sure that the policies and the provisions for it are handled correctly. The city of Boston apparently has a pretty good policy, but it has one serious flaw in it, that the police can view the video before they write up their report about the incident, which could, in the case of some police, skew their story about what actually happened. And we've seen incidents across the country where some bad police will write up a fake story and then find out later on there's a video and realize that the video doesn't comport with what they said, so they would have changed it if they could have seen the video first. Those are the kinds of things you want to make sure don't happen, so you need to do it right.
There's also been some criticism about the racial makeup of the officers who will be wearing these cameras. The police department says 55 of the participants are white, 29 black, 13 Latino, 3 Asian. Again, Mayor Marty Welsh was asked about this on WBUR's Morning Edition this week, and this is what he said.
I think that there's always going to be criticism on a lot of different things that we do. And I think I would appreciate if we could just, let's see how the pilot works before we start to criticize this. I mean, I don't know if we can ever make everybody happy all the time, but certainly we're moving forward here.
John Carroll?
Well, I think one of the objections is that black officers have been overrepresented in the 100 that have been chosen. 29 black officers, 24% of the force is black. So, but I think that that is a concern to some people, but I'm not sure that that's a major concern. One of the other bigger concerns is the neighborhoods that these are being deployed in. And one of the neighborhoods they're not being deployed in is East Boston. And I think there's some concern in that community that this pilot program does not include them. So there's always going to be people who are going to nitpick at these things. I think they did the best they could in terms of representation, but you're never going to please everybody.
Let's move on to politics, especially Democratic politics. Massachusetts State Senator Jamie Eldridge wrote a strongly worded email to some of his Beacon Hill colleagues this week urging progressive Democrats to, quote, take over the party, or he said maybe they should start a third political party. And all of this came as Vermont Senator and former Democratic former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders launched a new political group called Our Revolution to advance the causes that he had outlined during his campaign. Here's Sanders at the launch of his movement in Burlington, Vermont this week.
Over time, Our Revolution will involve hundreds of thousands of people. These are people who will be fighting at the grassroots level for changes in their local school boards, in their city councils, in their state legislatures, and in their representation in Washington.
So, John Carroll, I'm wondering what you're thinking about Senator, State Senator Eldridge asking folks to kind of take that in a different direction and perhaps unseat some Democrats at the state level.
Well, I can tell you it's pretty unpopular with the Democratic leadership in Massachusetts. They're very unhappy about it. But I think it shows a split that is reflected also in the charter school question, where the Democrats seem to be divided in terms of supporting a ballot question to expand charter schools or not.
Right.
So I think that's a problem for the state Democrats. In terms of the overall movement that Sanders is trying to start, I mean, Our Revolution is a good name for it because there was a major revolt of the staff when he brought on his former campaign manager.
Right.
So I think that there's all kinds of issues. I think Senator Eldridge complicated things in a way that probably is not helpful at this point.
Right. Arlene, was it bad form of Senator Eldridge to do this, as some Democrats have suggested, or was the timing right for him to say, look, this Our Revolution is happening, and let's capitalize off all of the movement that took place during the presidential campaign of Senator Sanders, and this is what needs to be done?
Well, as someone who spends a lot of time in the State House, I should say, yes, it was bad form. But truthfully, I actually see there have been divisions in the Democratic Party, as there have been in the Republican Party forever. It's healthy, in my opinion. There are plenty of conservative Democrats, conservadems. I sometimes jokingly call some of them closet Republicans. And they have every right to be as conservative as they want to be. But progressives like Eldridge have every right to try and replace them with more progressive Democrats. And the fact that some state legislators have taken umbrage at that, and John's right, they have, I think it's because they're a little too some of these folks are my friends in the legislature who are not happy with Jamie Eldridge, but I think some of these people are a little too insular and a little too protective of their own, and I understand why. It's because they work with some of the conservative Democrats, they get to know them, they get to like them, and they don't want to say, get rid of this guy that I work with and that I like. That's not political malfeasance, it's just human nature. But on the other hand, Jamie's right. If you're progressive, you should want to get rid of conservadems.
But so there were reports about, lawmakers being especially critical of each other at the end of the session. Some folks, some senators accusing House leaders, right, of including Speaker DeLeo, House Speaker DeLeo, of being a puppet of big business. And then some House members shot back and said senators are allowing Senate President Rosenberg to try to make a power grab. I mean, you don't think that this is any different than any other session? This is sort of politics as usual?
There's always been an institutional tension between the House and the Senate, and our state legislature is a little bit worse this time around because of some internal intrigue. But that always exists. And it can be healthy if people learn to work together despite the fact that they're going to disagree. In that way, it's no different than Congress.
It's interesting that the one person that the Democrats are not criticizing is Charlie Baker.
Well, exactly.
So Charlie Baker gets a complete pass while they have a civil war at the State House. It's lucky for him. It's another break for Charlie Baker.
Right. Well, let's shift gears now and talk quickly about driving on the Mass Pike and that all-electronic tolling that's set to begin in October. The State Transportation Department this week outlined how this tolling was going to work, said the toll that fares would go up, really, increase for a good number of commuters. State officials also said that this new system is capable of alerting police about specific license plates or EasyPass transponders. And some civil liberties groups, of course, are concerned about this. We're back to privacy again. Here's Cade Crockford, director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. She spoke with us about this on Monday.
The really critical issue is to make sure that not only the policies that MassDOT implements to protect this information are in line with basic privacy and data hygiene principles, but also the state constitution and the federal constitution.
So I'm wondering, Arlene, what's your initial reaction to the fact that this new system of electronic tolling will be able to track where people go and track license plates and all of that? And what do we do about some of the privacy questions that raises?
Yeah, Kate, the ACLU, the privacy advocates, raise a very good concern. There's always a concern about government surveillance. And the Department of Transportation needs to set appropriate policy to make sure we're not violating people's privacy rights while they're still achieving the goals they wish. But you do have to watch out for what information is gathered, how secure it is, how long, who can access it, how long it's stored for. Do private companies have the ability to access the information at some point, whether you want them to or not? So there are a lot of good questions that need to be dealt with before they implement the program, and hopefully the Department of Transportation will involve privacy advocates in those conversations.
John, your thoughts?
Well, I've been interested in the money part of this, actually, because the idea that driving from one end of the pike to the other is going to cost about the same amount, that's not exactly true. There are three categories of fares here, of tolls. One is for people with in-state transponders, one is for people with out-of-state transponders, and one is for people with no transponders who are going to really get hit hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, West Newton to downtown Boston, if you have a mass transponder, your toll just went up by 70%. If you have an out-of-state transponder, it doubled. And if you have no transponder, it almost tripled. So there's a lot of cost increases buried in here. The other part of the money that's interesting is the cost savings. It was claimed that there were going to be $50 million in annual cost savings. Now they're saying, well, it's more like $5 million in annual cost savings.
Oof, that's a big difference.
And there's a tremendous outlay. It's going to cost $130 million to implement this program. It's going to cost another $130 million to take down the toll booths. So there's a lot of money involved in this that hasn't been rising to the surface because of legitimate concerns about privacy, about tracking speed of cars, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But from a financial standpoint, this is going to hit a number of people really hard in terms of the tolls that they have to pay.
And what about money saved, not having toll workers? I mean, does that, have we heard hard numbers about that and how much that might help toward all of these other
there
costs?
There are 510 full or part-time toll workers. I think about 300 of them are going to get inducements to retire, which is going to cost another chunk of money. Mm. And then the others may be retrained, may be reassigned. That's all pretty much up in the air.
Yeah. Money, money, money. Well, let's end our segment today with our hubbubs. And those are the brief stories that maybe, didn't make the headlines, but they certainly caught our eye. Arlene, what's your hubbub for the week?
Well, there was a nice piece in the Beacon Hill Times about a new tour in downtown Boston on the Freedom Trail called the Freedom Trail Lantern Tours. They're 90-minute walking tours. They just started it last year for the first time, and apparently it was very successful. And they describe it this way, quote, "Dark history and mystery of the Freedom Trail. Investigate the ghoulish side of Boston's history. Tales too dark and macabre for daytime. True accounts of appalling crimes. Fatal sword duels. The grave of a ruthless pirate. Tales of scandalous murders and the punishment of convicted witches." So they take folks to the Boston Massacre site, to the old State House where there was an old jail, to the burying grounds. And it sounds fabulous. If you like history or stories or fun on a fall evening, you should check out the Freedom Trail Foundation website.
And when do they start?
I think in late September, October.
All right. And John,
you've got a pretty good marketing program, too, don't they? So my hubbub comes from a really neat piece by Hayden Bird at Boston.com that came out this week about a movement in the 60s in Boston to replace the Boston Garden, to vacate Fenway Park, and to build a sports stadium down by South Station. This was part of John Collins's New Boston. There was a Greater Boston Sports Authority that was formed, and it's such a fabulous Boston story because they went through 30 different design versions before they actually dumped this thing.
Like the big dig.
Exactly. And the outrageous price that this was going to cost was $98 million, and people were up in arms. So eventually it was abandoned back in the 60s, but it's a terrific piece. Everybody should check it out, Boston.com.
Okay, well, mine is The Legend of Wessie. Have you guys heard about The Legend of Wessie? Okay, now this is from Westbrook, Maine, and Wessie is the name that was given to this mysterious snake that people are reporting to the police in Westbrook, which is a town just northwest of Portland. And in June, it first came out that a woman reported that she saw a 10-foot-long snake with a head the size of a soccer ball on the banks of the Presumpscot River. And then two police officers said they also saw a very large snake in that same area. Then somebody found a 10 to 12 foot long snake skin. Same place. And then just this week, another report of this large snake in that area. So local businesses are getting on the Wessie bandwagon. They have T-shirts. They have beer. They're writing songs about Wessie. And someone has come up with a Wessie Twitter account that says, quote, hanging out in Westbrook, shedding my skin, hungry, so very hungry. My head is not the size of a soccer ball. You'll never take me alive. Westbrook PD.
I think it's two local kids in a costume, actually.
He's on the Freedom Trail, too, you know.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. John Carroll, WBUR senior media analyst and professor of communication at Boston University. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Also, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Maine Governor Paul LePage leaves a threatening, explicit voicemail for a Democratic state lawmaker to counter criticism that he's racist. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.